Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
Butterflies that sleep among the wheat. I make them into mutton pies and sell them in the street. I sell them unto men, he said, who sail on stormy seas, and that's the way I get my bread, a trifle, if you please. But I was thinking of a plan to dye one's whiskers green and always use so large a fan that they could not be seen. So having no reply to give to what the old man said, I cried, "Come, tell me how you live," and thumped him on the head. His accents mild took up the tale. He said, "I go my ways, and when I find a mountain rail, I set it in a blaze. And thence they make a stuff they call Roland's Massacre Oil. Yet twopence halfpenny is all they give me for my toil. But I was thinking of a way to feed oneself on batter, and so go on from day to day, getting a little fatter." I shook him well from side to side until his face was blue. "Come, tell me how you live," I cried, "and what it is you do." He said, "I hunt for haddock's eyes among the heather bright. I work them into waistcoat buttons in the silent night. And these I do not sell for gold or coin of silvery shine, but for a copper halfpenny, and that will purchase nine. I sometimes dig for buttered rolls and set lime twigs for crabs. I sometimes search the grassy knolls for wheels of handsome cabs. That's the way," he gave a wink, "by which I get my wealth. And very gladly I will drink to your honor's noble health." I heard him then, for I had just completed my design to keep the Minia Bridge from rust by boiling it in wine. I thanked him much for telling me the way he got his wealth, but chiefly for his wish that he might drink my noble health. And now, if ever a chance I put my finger into glue, or madly squeeze a right-hand foot into a left-hand shoe, or if I drop upon my toe a very heavy weight, I weep, for it reminds me so of that old man I used to know, whose look was mild, whose speech was slow, whose hair was wither than the snow, whose face was very like a crow, his eyes cinders all aglow, who seemed distracted with his woe, who rocked his body to and fro, and muttered mumbling and low. If his mouth were full of dough, he snorted like a buffalo, that summer evening long ago, a-sitting on a gate. Greetings, 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 and welcome to Zariana Radio. This is your host and humble storyteller, Evan Poss. And I'm here outside on a lovely early autumn morning with producer, engineer, Daniel Michael. How are you doing, Dan?
I am doing well, and I would like to comment that we have a couple of callers that we're going to get to. We actually have two callers on the line right now. And also Vicky Chack, who's visited your show before. Remember she mentioned, was it last week or the week before, we were talking about that cartoon mentioning the Hindu epic.
Pinks of Blues, right?
That was it. You have to remember that for me, this is like 5 o'clock in the morning because I work the late night shift. Sometimes, I've often said that if I do a nighttime show, you might get a little more of my witty side because I might be more awake. But
and it's a little bit delirious.
But perhaps me being halfway into this world and the dream world helps for a show like ours. Both this one and the Wednesday one.
Well, you know, certainly getting some good energy from the sun here. It's beautiful out.
It's an amazing day.
And already, since we mentioned Streets of Sinclair Blues already, go ahead and recommend that to everyone out there. It's free to watch on the internet. Absolutely free by the artist, the director who put this movie together. I think she was in San Francisco. Really, really clever bit about the Ramayana, kind of from a Western feminist perspective. Very clever, very well done. You know, definitely some good modern myth making there. So I'd encourage everyone to check that out if they get a chance.
One of my favorite sayings is new thought, ancient wisdom. Is, you know, everything is not going to be exactly like it was, of course, and naturally in the olden times with some myths. We always adopt them. Or I remember one person I was conversing with saying, there are things that worked for the ancestors, and then there's things that work for you.
Absolutely.
Such as one of the ones you're going to be reading from today. We do have some callers, though, and we'll get to them in just a minute.
Yes.
But you often talk about, just to give folks a brief history, and welcome to Main Street Universe, welcome to Zarianna Radio, but you often talk about the Hindu pantheons and Eastern, as well as your own pantheon. And also, today we'll be reading from one of your favorite modern authors, which will be Mr. Gene Wolfe. So that's sort of old thought, new thought, ancient wisdom, I think, all combined. And I'm going to go ahead to this 267. And I'm turning the microphone slowly on now. Hello, 267.
Hey, how you doing today?
Doing well. And were you calling for a conversation or general reading? As you know, some people see
general
in our market.
Reading.
You mentioned tarot readings as well.
General reading.
Okay, Evan?
All right. So just a general reading, nothing in particular?
It's about school and a relationship. First and foremost, it's about a relationship with the Great Charity a while ago. People give me different views on it. Do you see anything coming from that or anything in the future?
All right, let's see. So, we're doing for the relationship.
Great.
Get the cards out.
For those of you who want a visual, Evan has this really attractive white silk scarf that was, it was blessed by a Buddhist monk, right? Or something of that nature.
Rinpoche, a Tibetan Lama. I drew three cards, and what I see here is a lot of potential. I see a lot of potential for this relationship. Not all that potential has come to fruition yet. A lot of it's waiting there, you know, if you're willing to go ahead with it.
Yeah, but I've never...
Sorry?
I never met Charity. This is the thing. She lives in Somerset, New Jersey, and I live in Philly. So a long distance thing, but we haven't really met. Do you see anything happening from that?
All right, well, let me explain a little bit of this. The first card I drew is the Six of Wands, inverted, which is the Victory card. It's very auspicious. The card is upside down, which makes sense in this situation. It is all in the stage of potential right now. So, you know, you haven't met her yet. You're probably wondering how to go about this or what to do. I can't tell you any particulars as to how to go about this, but what I can tell you is that there is a great deal of potential in this relationship. The Victory card inverted means that the victory is present. It hasn't revealed itself yet. And it doesn't necessarily have to reveal itself either. It's not to say that this is a sure thing or anything. But it's sitting there. It's out there. You know, the potential is there for it. So, you know, I would, might be worth taking a risk here.
Because the thing is, do you see me waiting for that right person?
Sorry?
I'm waiting for the right person to come now. Is she the right person or somebody else is?
Oh, okay. I think you
think well, the second card I drew is the Ace of Wands, which is right side up. And this is, you know, how to explain the Ace of Wands. It's
new idea, something new. It's just newness, potential.
Right. As Dan's saying, it's a new card. Again, it kind of goes with the first two. The third is a Chariot. I'm going to draw one more.
The two of them.
So now we have the Ten of Wands. So there's lots of wands here. I think what that indicates is that this, you know, the relationship could work if you're looking for the right person, and you know, this is a very common thing.
No, still pure, so yeah.
Now you have, and you know, honestly, I don't have any more answers to this than you would. There's always a question that we all ask ourselves is there one right person out there for me? Or, you know, are there even a couple right people out there for me? And if I meet one of them, then it could work. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, to what degree that corresponds with reality, you know, we really have to look inside ourselves and see. Are there, you know, is there that perfect soulmate for you? Or for anyone, is, you know, such a concept that, you know, we like to dream about, is that the truth? What I see here is that this could definitely work. It will take a lot of work.
Yeah, I'm seeing patience here.
You know, like any good relationship, even if everything else is right, it's still going to take a full investment of yourself. Mm-hmm. Nothing's easy, you know. Just look at people in your lives who are in relationships together, you know, either married or not married. But, you know, it's always a struggle. You have to, it's a give and a take, you know. There's two sides interacting and two wills, two human beings coming together. So you have to, you know, you have to be patient. If you want it to work, you have to decide if this person is worth it. You know,
yeah,
if this is what you want, I would say the signs are there. Go ahead, absolutely. Make an effort. But if you're going
to
make an effort, invest all of yourself in it, you know?
Yeah, because she said that he always comes to the wrong. I was calling her up and texting her all the time. She said, I came off stalker, so I'm not a stalker. It's just the conversation, so I kind of rubbed it the wrong way, you know what I mean? Never been harmed by it.
Right. And I'm definitely getting
from this particular reading, there's a lot of work and a lot of patience. And then I pulled another card just from my deck, and I'm getting there's the Ace of Cups reverse, which cups involve emotion and involve love. And when it's reversed, I'm thinking, like Evan said, there's a potential, but this, you know, some readings will be all about action, and I'm getting a lot of there's just patience from this, and allow things to evolve naturally. It's not going to happen right away. It's not going to happen quickly. It doesn't mean necessarily wrong person, but it means it's time to, you know, we all can be a bit impatient. This is telling me this is a time for patience. I know that's not like a great dramatic sexy ending to a reading that someone always wants. Some readings are about go now, take action, do this, do that. This is one telling me calmness, patience, and involving being cups involves matters of emotion, and this is kind of a time to pull back and be patient. And maybe there's a good new person coming into the picture is what I'm getting from the cards that I drew. And if you be patient, I think you might be looking at a better opportunity coming soon. That 'cause the Ace of Cups is emotion, and it was reversed, and I'm guessing you were thinking of the one person, but if you're patient, I have a feeling someone more interesting might be coming along in the near future. In fact, I'll draw one. Swords, fairly near future. There's often time associations with, you know, the coins are of earth, swords are of air, cups are of water, wands are of fire. And this was a Six of Swords, so within a few months, I think, because six is a pretty good amount of swords weighing down that boat. Now, I'm talking to people that know the images of the card. It's six swords in a boat and a guy sort of slowly pushing this boat. So I'm actually getting the impression, just because I had the urge to pick a few cards of my own, that there might be something new and more interesting on the horizon.
And again, you know, with tarot cards, and, you know, I'm someone who will say this outright, you know, even if I'm doing a reading for someone else, the cards shouldn't be telling you anything that you don't already know. You know, that's something I've discovered for myself using the cards for my own purposes. And I'm fairly new to doing readings for other people. They're a tool for your intuition to work itself on. You know,
okay.
We all have, you know, we kind of know within ourselves. You get a feeling, you know, me and my good friend talk about this quite often. You kind of know. You know, you get a feeling already, like, is this the right thing to do or isn't it?
Yes.
And very often it's such a slight feeling, and it, you know, it's so vague, and we want something.
And the emotion.
But the emotion is, you know, just slightly dissonant. We go ahead with it anyways, which is good, because, you know, you can't live your life just wondering about things and, you know, well, I'm getting like a slight ambiguous feeling here, so I'm not going to take any action. You know, that's not it either. Take action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be patient. Be, you know, go about it intelligently.
Right,
you know,
right.
Don't let it be an excuse for inaction. But
right.
Trust your intuition, you know. You there should be a part of you that, you know, that knows what you want, that knows what's right. And, you know.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Okay, like I said, I'm seeing that something better might be on the horizon, like a new interest with the eight cups there. So there might be some debate going on as to who is the right person, and I think it might be someone new coming up.
All right, take care.
Thank you much. And thank you for joining Main Street Universe, and we have another caller, Evan. And it's 917.
All right.
Hello, 917, you're on the air.
Good morning, how are you guys?
Good morning.
Lots of energy in that. Whoa.
Yeah,
how are
you? You both of you guys, your voices are nice. I forgot what I was calling in about. Let me focus.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. And your voice is nice as well.
Thank you. I was
high energy,
because I wanted to know. Yes. If I could do five jumping jacks right now, I would. I have a question. I would like to know about my absolutely amazing boyfriend, Corey, and what do you guys get from him?
your amazing boyfriend, Corey. Well, it sounds like you already know, first of all.
Sounds like you're already kind of happy with him.
Absolutely amazing.
It must be new. Has he like been your boyfriend for like 2 weeks or something? Girls are never impressed with a man that for that long. I mean, come on.
He's talking to you, too. One of you is absolutely, and the other one is amazing.
Oh, okay. Wait, is this my girlfriend? No, I'm just playing. No, I know it wouldn't be if she was saying I was amazing. Ha. All right, Evan's drawing the cards now. Let's see what's up. I'm going to go get my tea. I'll be right back.
It looks to me like...
Whoa, sorry.
Oh, we just dropped Laurie. All right. Looks like there's lots of energy, and, you know, the cards kind of reflect what's in your voice. Sounds like you two definitely have something very good together. There's also the five of discs, which means basically worry. So, you know, that's a little bit of an indication, you know, and I think that's something that always happens. You meet someone new, you're a little bit worried, like, you know, they're right,
yes.
It's too good to be true, you know.
Yes.
And that's a very natural thing. But the important thing is, you know, not to let that get in the way. You know, it reminds me that there's a lot of classic fairy tales where, you know, everything's, like, going perfect and everything's just, like, too good to be true. And then they're like, all right,
yeah.
There's just one thing that you don't have to do. Like, don't open that box over there or, you know, like, don't eat the pomegranate seed or something like that. And then it's just like, all right, I have to eat the pomegranate seed or I have to open the box. And it's like, why did you do it? Everything was perfect. But... So... Again, as I'll often say, especially for readings regarding love and relationships, you know, I think that, you know, in your heart, you know far better than these cards do, or
yes.
That I could be able to read these cards to you. But the only negative thing I'm seeing here is the worry. Not necessarily anything, you know, that has its foundation in anything else.
Okay.
I have actually two of the same cards again, which are the Ace of Wands and the Chariot.
Okay.
And Dandrew's Strength.
These are all pretty good, and some major arcana pretty good, like Chariot is... charging forward, go ahead, and strength is, but just remember to keep your control about you. It seems like you're really into this, and sometimes when we can lose ourselves. Like, ever had, like, a new girlfriend, or I'm kind of speaking to Evan now, and you, like, for instance, Evan and I are both artists, and sometimes you get a new girlfriend or something like that, and you get so into her that maybe you lose a portion of yourself. You stop doing your writing or you stop doing your music or something like that. This is a card just reminding me that this is very, very positive, but to remember to keep your strength and keep yourself about you as well. So to me, these are looking like really good cards for this.
Okay.
Yep. You know, like I said, you will know, you know, better than we ever will. The cards all look good to me.
Yes.
Definitely some auspicious cards. Like Dan was saying, lots of energy. Strength, the Ace of Wands, the Chariot.
Yeah.
All cards with a lot of power to them, you know. Fiery, so, you know, you hear that in your voice. I can only say best of luck with it and best of wishes and, you know.
And remember to keep yourself in the process, of course.
Yeah,
it sounds like really
why you should be in quiet.
Yeah.
What's that?
Can you see why he's been being quiet?
He's quiet?
Oh.
Yes.
Well,
let's see. Again, this could be, and this is the one and only issue I'm seeing in this is...
Let me have a half more place.
This is Four of Wands reverse, and it's just saying, well, sometimes people are reserved because of be natural. So you have a thing where, okay, I might be reserved or quiet about things because of some instability in the past or things in the past, because four is about stability and earthly, grounded structural wisdom. And so sometimes it's not doom and gloom. It's again, I think this is a very good reading with some good major arcana going on. So it looks like this
okay,
is going to
so
work out.
Okay, so he's just quiet for some instability in his past.
Well, here's another thing too.
Or just a fear of it.
When you,
which is natural.
I mean, it's always important to realize, you know, that other people. I think it's easy to make the mistake. And, you know, we have our own personality, and there's like the way you think in your head, and you know, each of us acts a certain way. We kind of assume that everyone else, you know, kind of will act and think the same way we do. You know, I've definitely noticed this in my own experience. You know, if like two people are together and one of them is very outspoken, you know, very lively, you know, talkative and stuff like that, the other person, you know, might just naturally be a more reserved person, doesn't talk as much. You know, that's simply, you know, how their mind works.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just their personality type.
Definitely.
And the other person is like, well, you know, why aren't you, like, talking as much as I am? Or, you know, this, like, don't feel like they're showing the same enthusiasm. But, you know, it's all there. It's just on the inside, you know, they don't show it in the same way. It's not a bad thing at all. It's just a different type of personality.
Oh, okay, absolutely. That's how he is.
You know, this is a very, very common thing. And, you know, it all too often it leads to misunderstandings, which shouldn't be there at all. Because, you know, this other person, it's all there. It's, you know, it's just not being reflected in the same way. But, you know, don't let yourself get down on that. It's just a different way of expression. It's a different type of personality, which, you know, has its own virtues in many ways. Some people are just naturally more inclined to be quiet and reserved. But again, it's for no lack of emotion or feeling or anything like that. It's just how they express themselves. So on that note, I would just say, you know, have some understanding and, you know, go with it.
It seemed like positivity in the reading itself, for sure.
Good.
But remember to keep your strength about you and to keep yourself about you. And it seems like it'll be.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for calling.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you, and thank you for joining me on.
Yeah, but you're going to sound like you're getting ready to do push-ups now. Like, we'll finish with them. Let's go do some push-ups.
Yeah, it's funny because I actually was. We're outside, and I was thinking of doing some push-ups.
I know you were.
I work late night shift, and as Evan and some of my listeners know, so this feels like 5 in the morning to me. So I actually was considering doing some push-ups to kind of wake up a little bit.
You were doing some push-ups when you first pulled the cars out. I heard you in the background.
All right, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, and you guys. Your information for more readings is on what is your website?
Oh, okay, yeah, www.mainstreetuniverse.com. We actually have many shows. We have, like, four, going to be 5 shows soon. It's like, or mini network here on Blog Talk Radio. And it's www.mainstreetuniverse.com. We also have a Facebook page and a Facebook presence. And we have 4 different shows. We got Main Street Universe. We got Today Shows, Ariana Radio. We have Walking on the Sidewalk. And on Friday night, and as well as on Friday night at midnight, we have Jessie George, and she does, she's sort of a life coach and such, and wrote a book called Activating Compassion, and she's our new Friday night at midnight hour. Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour is the name of her show. So we got 4 shows. Main Street Universe, if you Google it up, we come up, especially if you do it for words, like www.mainstreetuniverse.com.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, guys.
Okay,
and
well,
you,
thank
you.
Do
you guys do private reading?
Yes, I would say look us up on Facebook. Look up Daniel
Main Street
Universe. Or look up
thank you.
Daniel Nolan Michael, which is my name. And my personal Facebook thing should come up. So Daniel.
Thank you.
Nolan Michael. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day. Bye.
Okay. And the microphone, I'm clicking it off. And there it is. And Evan, I believe it is myth time now.
All right. Excellent. So there's a piece that I've been talking about. I mentioned from time to time on this show, which has had a lot of influence on me. This actually is not a story, although it is very entertaining. It's an essay by, as Dan mentioned earlier, the illustrious Gene Wolfe. And it's called How Science Will Conquer the World for Fantasy. Now, I cannot overstress how important I feel this piece is. It seems like it should be quite dated. This is from 1982. And yet it's so relevant and seems so modern, you know, in what it's talking about. And, you know, for me, this is vital. This is like, this right here is the essence of this show, of, you know, what we're trying to accomplish here. And, you know, this is kind of a one of those early precursors to what I like to call the techno-paganism, a term I actually got from Terence McKenna, who is another great writer, thinker, philosopher, activist for the psychedelic community. And yes, absolutely. And a wonderful community it is. He's kind of like the patron saint. But, you know, he talks about what he terms techno-pagans at the end of history. And, you know, as that's like kind of the direction we're going, we're coming full circle into an archaic revival. That's what he calls it. He has a book by that title. A term he throws around a lot. And, you know, this really sums up the essence very nicely. The archaic revival. So think of some of these terms. You know, Gene Wolfe doesn't use any of those. You know, I've never heard him use it, throw on the terms techno-pagan or archaic revival. But I think they lend a lot to what he's talking about here. So pay attention, folks. This is a good one right here. How science will conquer the world for fantasy. For most particular purposes, we now can be divided into five: poets, alchemists, kings, dragons, and churls. It has been a lot like chess, but simpler. Churls make up the largest group, well over 90%. But they have the least influence. They are the hewers of wood and the drawers of water, the tenders of machines, the soldiers in the tanks, and the clerks and clerics in their ranks. They are those who serve without love and never of themselves question the service. The young man in Scotland I read of recently, who had been out of work for more than 2 years, but who had never considered starting some sort of enterprise for himself that would employ him, shoveling snow, say, or going door to door offering to wash cars or windows, is a churl. Dragons are those whose primary thoughts are gold. And forgive me, folks, my voice is not all here today. I'm just getting back over the weather here. Dragons are those whose primary thoughts are of gold. If the young Scot had begun that car washing, and if he had soon employed others in advertising the Yellow Pages, he would probably have become a dragon. Kings are those whose thoughts are of power. Most captains of industry, as they used to be called, are dragons, but some are kings. Most military officers are churls, though a few are kings. Alexander Haig is a fine example. Not all kings have crowns or even much power. Archie Bunker, the loading dock foreman, whose great concern was exercising authority over his little family, was a king. An unsuccessful king, but a king nevertheless. Every politician who attains high rank is a king, with only minuscule exceptions. Paradoxically, the only way for a nation to avoid being ruled by a king is for it to set up some system of hereditary monarchy. Then the results are liable to be worse. Alchemists are those who seek truth. Judges, scientists, and philosophers, who are a kind of scientists, though they have forgotten it, and even a few clergymen are alchemists. So are most engineers and many physicians. Poets are such as love dream. Since you are reading this, or listening to it as the case may be, you are presumably a poet. Clearly, no one is confined to a single category. A man may be a king on the job and a churl at home. A woman may be a poet in love and a king in marriage. But most people are churls and nothing but churls throughout their lives. For as long as tongues have wagged, they have said that kings rule the world. They do not, and they never have. What they have ruled has been a narrow circle of human affairs, and for the most part, they have ruled that only as a queen bee may be said to rule the hive. Human nature does not change at the edict of a king. And most certainly, the storm does not cease to blow upon his word. Nor do geese aim their arrows to the south for any human being. If Alexander had in fact wept because there remained no worlds to conquer, he should, like Canute, have ordered back the tide. He would have discovered that this world of Earth has yet to feel so much as a pinprick. In the 18th century, sages remarked that the only things princes learned to do well was ride. A horse does not care about the rank of the man on its back. Alexander, who loved his horse Bucephalus more than any man or woman, would have understood that, at least. How foolish it sounds to speak of conquering the world. It summons up two images: the madman ranting at the wind, and that of the first wise woman, who, moved by what genius no one can now say, scratched the soil and scattered the seeds of edible grasses. Let me say at once that the madman is correct, however mad, and that the wise woman mistaken, if we unwisely suppose her bent, with her stick, upon conquest. To shout orders at the moaning wind is not to conquer the world, but if the world is ever conquered, its conquerors will hear the wind obey. To grow wheat, dam rivers, and tame the fierce force of the primal guinea pig is not to conquer the world. To shoot or cage the last wild tiger is not to conquer the world either, only to impoverish it. Most certainly, to overgraze a plain until it turns to a desert is not to conquer, but to be conquered. Earlier, I said that no one was confined to a single category. Nearly all of us, poets, kings, or what have you, are nature's churls. It has always been so, but it need not remain so much longer. The next century is apt to see the end of meteorology as a predictive science, and its beginning as a manipulative science. Merely as an example, Consider what might be done today with a space shuttle. A thin cloud of light-absorbent particles in orbit high above the desert of the southwest could readily lower the summer temperature there by several degrees, which in turn would mean less evaporation and more condensation, and thus more water. Such a cloud would disperse slowly of its own accord, and it would probably be unnecessary to remove it at the approach of winter. If reflective particles were used instead, say, aluminum dust instead of carbon, it would even be possible to position a cloud that reflected heat and light towards Minnesota while it shaded Arizona. Hurricanes, like just about every other sort of meteorological phenomena, depend upon temperature gradients. By controlling the amount of sunlight striking the appropriate part of the Earth, it should be possible to control them. And that is something that could be tried not in 2001, but next year, which would have been 1983, by the way. Thus, the alchemist, or at least one kind of alchemist, will become that fantasy figure, the weather wizard. Finns, you know, can call up a storm and whistle for a wind. But then Finns are all warlocks anyhow. Soon, however, there will be no need to send up the shuttle every time some storm is to be calmed or caused. That work will be handled by permanent weather control satellites. These, in turn, could be instructed by observers at or near the affected area by radio. What difference now between a weather wizard and a controlling meteorologist? Only that we know, or rather, that we think we know, how the latter will do it. We shall probably continue to think so until a few of us are unlucky enough to gain control of this equipment and turn sorcerer's apprentice. Will the ranked thunderheads march the quickening tempos of Dukas? In our minds, very likely. Musicians are poets, after all. All this is minor, of course, though not besides the point. As every churl knows, the genuine stuff of fantasy is monsters, trolls, elves, and unicorns. Particularly unicorns. It would be old, pointed, star-spangled hat of me to insist here that genetic engineering will soon permit any devoted hobbyist to putting a narwhal's tooth on a horse's head. I've already said that in The Woman the Unicorn Loved and in a published interview. Yet it is so. The technology is on our doorstep. If I may be permitted to repeat myself just once, Columbia now offers undergraduate training in gene splicing. The will is certainly present. The World Fantasy Convention felt it necessary to ban unicorns from the art show, charging them with terminal banality. In the interview previously referred to, the interviewer asked if I did not feel the genetic manipulators would use their knowledge to create more mere kitsch and corn rather than recognizable mythical beasts. Alas, most recognizable mythical beasts are kitsched already, and corn too. But where, even now the plaintiff question sounds, will the unicorns graze? Where will the chimera's lair and the fawn skip? The answer, as we might expect, is already there, in 1,000 fantasies and 100,000 fairy tales. In the wet, wild wood, the great, untamed, singing forest of the world, the forest at the ends of the earth. Did I hear you say, churl, that there are no such forests, that those we have, the jungles of the Amazon basin, for example, are already being cut for lumber? Ah, but there shall be forests, the forests of fairies, soon. Weather control we have talked of already. The world's hunger will gnaw like a rat as fossil fuels are exhausted. Furthermore, the burning of fuels of all types is increasing the atmosphere's carbon dioxide to levels that are already dangerous. Even now, the early returns are coming in from the polar ice. Carbon dioxide can be readily removed from the air by growing plants, which retain the carbon and excrete oxygen, both vital for supporting combustion and for sustaining animal life. For 50 years or so, science fiction has suggested gardens in spaceships, generally favoring plants that would add zest to the astronauts' diet. Earth herself is on a long space flight, and her conditions are ideal for the employment of such plants. There's no need to generate artificial light for them, for example. One variety in particular is particularly well-suited to the purpose. Trees do not need weeding or annual replanting. They supply food, though it has received no publicity. One of the more promising projects for genetic engineering is the development of an oak that will bear edible acorns, but even the present wild varieties supply excellent forage for swine. Fuel, paper, building materials, and feedstocks for a whole host of chemical processes. They prevent erosion and enrich the soil. Vast stretches of Australia, North Africa, Central Asia, and North and South America are available for conversion to forest. And that will be necessary. And all that will be necessary is a little less sun and some wet winds driven ashore. The unicorn and the hippogriff will not be the only residents of these forests. In the existing forests of places like romantic Canada and far-off Pennsylvania. And they certainly will not be the only interesting ones. One of my favorite bumper stickers is "Support your right to arm bears." But of course, bears do not really need assault rifles or Saturday night specials. Bears are very well armed already. What bears need are better brains. Oh, that sort of bear. They will get them, and so will deer, rabbits, and just about every other kind of animal that is not already rare and that is soft and cuddly and in infancy and possessed of large and melting brown eyes. All that will be necessary is to graft the genes governing frontal lobe development in human beings into the genetic structures of the appropriate animal in such a way that the trait will be Mendelian dominant. Heroes of old licked the blood of the great worm or the enchanted fish from their fingers and understood the speech of beasts. The beasts themselves are about to lick it at last. If what I've been writing here sounds revolutionary to you, you're out of touch with the scientific progress of the past few years. But now I'm going to say something that is truly revolutionary. Something that, as far as I know, has not been said before by anyone. It is that the landscape of fantasy is no more the landscape of myth, as is often alleged, than it is the landscape of medieval Europe or of Attic Greece. That it is a landscape of the future, and no very remote future at that. We will have it, and we will have it because we want it. Or rather, because we poets have taught so many alchemists to want it, planting the suggestion in stories and essays like this one. What of the high-tech future envisioned by science fiction? We will have that too. Indeed, we have a great deal of it already. We will have it in the new cities of education and technology. The old cities will be abandoned to the werewolves and their allies, I think. We will have it in the orbiting space colonies and in cities on the moon and Mars. But in the rest, and that rest will have 1,000 times the area. We will have the meadows and woods, beast fable, centaurs, and magical weapons. No, I am not a satirist. I am serious. A serious satirist, if you like. The game of chess has been the game of life until very recently. You can even think of the kings as kings, dragons as queens, poets as knights, and so on. There is another game, however, appropriately enough, called fairy chess, in which the players can invent new pieces and even changed the shape of the board, imagining a cylindrical one, for example. But the game we are preparing to play now will be like none ever seen before. It will be a game in which the pieces invent new pieces. Pieces that prove to care little for gold, power, truth, or dream, and even control the shape of the board. And if that is not a world of fantasy, Alice never slept.
I love the part about how he predicts the potential and maybe eventual reality of the talking animals.
Oh, yeah. The highly intelligent, frontal lobe-developed animals with human speech. That's all anyone really wants, isn't it?
Yeah, to talk. Actually talk to their cat.
And that's all human beings are dreaming of. We just want to be able to talk to our cats. The deer comes in from the forest, you know, and you can talk to it just like Snow White. I'm going to read, I love this last paragraph here. I'm going to get one more read. The game of chess has been the game of life until very recently. You can even think of the kings as kings, dragons as queens, poets as knights, and so on. There is another game, however, appropriately enough called fairy chess, in which the players can invent new pieces and even change the shape of the board, imagining a cylindrical one, for example. But the game we're preparing to play in now will be like none ever seen before. It will be a game in which the pieces invent new pieces, pieces that may prove to care little for gold, power, truth, or dream, and even control the shape of the board. So that's kind of where we're at right now, huh? We're pieces who are realizing we can create new pieces. Change the shape of the board. Change the name of the game. And it's, you know, it is somewhat inevitable because we can't help ourselves. That's what we do. We're human beings. We create. You know, as soon as we first had the ability, we began changing the shape of the board. Although we might not have realized it. Now we realize what we do. We realize our role in all this. We're creating new pieces all the time.
And
but we're not thinking about it. Nor are we realizing the potential of what we could be creating. You know, there's so many things going on that are dictating how we go about this. You know, squandering this potential that we have. You know, so what are we creating now? Well, you know, there's so much good work out in the world, but there's also, you know, so many scientists who should be working on bringing these forests back and creating, you know, talking, skipping fauns and centaurs who are instead employed by, you know, the military-industrial complex or Monsanto or, you know, the goal here is to buy off all the best minds and get them working for you. But it's not a very egalitarian vision. You know, it's not what we're going for. I don't think that's what we want. It's certainly not what I want. And I love how he put it. We will have it, and we will have it because we want it. Or rather, because we poets have taught so many alchemists to want it. Planting a suggestion in stories and in essays such as this one. Well, you know, that's the role of the poets. That's the role of the story. And that is why we are here, folks. That's why I do a show every Thursday morning. Why I spend my time compulsively poring over all the folklore, mythology, science fiction, and fantasy I could possibly get my hands on. And so many others doing the exact same thing. They're not just stories. It's not, you know, just a momentary pleasure, you know, for the sake of, you know, entertainment. Although it is very entertaining. The stories can actually change the world. We've seen it happen so many times. The stories that we adhere to are so important. So, you know, let's turn that imagination on. Use it to its fullest potential. Let's think about where we're living, what we're doing, and what we could be doing. So, you know, anyone wants to call in and have any comments or questions or concerns, please do. Dan, anything else?
Yeah, well, I like how you mentioned the idea of how important myths are and how important role they play, not only just, as you said, just as far as entertainment and personal value and all these things, but in society as a whole. Like, for example, I'm going to be doing a show in a couple weeks based on a great special that I saw on BBC, British Broadcasting, and called How Art Made the World. And they discuss that, as some people have thought in the past, that first there was civilization and then there was myth and religion. This is actually saying first there was myth and religion and then they created civilization to accommodate the structures involved with the myth and religion. So it's like saying that those things came first, which of course they did. They come from in and without. It's just an interesting documentary. And Vicky was mentioning she can't call right now, but she wanted to say that just making the assumption that peace can be accomplished, war is not inevitable, can help to transform the world. And she may be a new Gene Wolfe fan, because she heard your story, said, what a creative mind, or something to that effect, so I told her it was Gene Wolfe. And his most well-known work, I guess, would be the Book of the New Sun, right?
The Book of the New Sun, yeah. It's considered to be his magnum opus. Probably the place to start, I would say. He's also got a lot of really, really good short story collections out there. You know, depending on if you're into the long fiction or the short fiction form, he's definitely a master of both. But, you know, I like what you're saying, and you gotta think about like the earliest human, you know, that point where it turned into civilization. What sort of questions, you know, led to this? Where this came from? The kings, you know, I suppose like the king or the monarch is the classic sign of civilization, right? We're civilized once we have someone to rule over us. Where did the kings come from? How did the king have his right to rule? Where did the right to rule come from? It was always divine right.
It was the goddess or some, you know, the supernatural entity.
Still
mythical being or god of some sort.
Still today, there are rulers claiming this. like in Korea, for instance.
Well, in the United States, too, to a lesser extent, they have to. Because otherwise, what right do they have, you know? Because it's always like, well, you know, why I'm a human being, you're a human being, what gives you the right to rule over the rest of us? Well, if one of these human beings was chosen by, you know, the divine powers that be, well, that settles the question then and there. So then you build up a structure around it. All right, well, the divine chooses his successor or his representative on Earth in this way. You know, we go back to ancient Egypt, 3000 BC, the pharaohs, you know, were gods on Earth. Ancient Sumeria, you know, 2500 BC, the king consummated his right with the high priestess who was representative of the goddess Enheduanna, or sorry, the goddess Inanna Ishtar, Inanna being one of her high priestesses, and actually the first poet, who was, yes, folks, a female. The first poet known by name in all of human history, the earliest, was a she. So, you know, you have to create these structures in order to make it believable and, you know, also imposing. There has to be a level of intimidation here, right? Build large buildings so that the people, you know, will stand in awe in front of it. No one but the true chosen hand of God could possibly live in such a place or have built such a structure. You know, surely, you know, it must come from there. And, you know, history just sort of evolves from there in so many ways. And, you know, we still have these vestigial remnants of it all over the place today. No president of the United States is going to forget to say God bless America. You have to. You know, and in a certain sense, it's, you know, there's still some of that divine right there.
We're gonna drop a tune for you folks right now.
This one's called Wizard Page Shuttle.
And Evan had a part in writing this, right?
Oh yeah, it's just Ben Snyder wig and many like nice just to the frequencies.
Thank you.
track called Interspace Shuttle. So, the story I got for you folks today.
And to let folks know, we were outside, and there was a lot of noise outside, so we put a song on, and we moved everything into Cafe Fairfax, which is the little music studio that we have here.
You probably heard.
Yes. And we have drums. And fun thing to bang on here.
All right. Now we have a really clever tale by Ukrainian, I think. Writer, really prolific, I think in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Stanislaw Lem. And these tales are very clever. The collection, this comes from a collection of short stories called Mortal Engines. And basically, they are fairy tales about robots. You know, kind of, don't really know how else to put it. It's pretty much exactly what they are. And they're all written kind of in, you know, classic fairy tale fashion with the language and the... There's another really good one that I'll read someday called How Erg the Self-Inducting Slew the Paleface. That's one of my favorites. We'll definitely do that one week. All right, so the Three Electro Knights. Once there lived a certain great inventor-constructor who, never flagging, thought up unusual devices and fashioned the most amazing mechanisms. He built himself a digital midget widget that sang sweetly, and he named it a bird. A bold heart served as his symbol, and every atom that passed through his hands bore that mark. So that afterwards, scientists did marvel to find in among the atomic spectra flickering valentines. He made many useful machines, both large and small, until the whimsical notion came to him to unite life and death in one and thereby accomplish the impossible. So he decided to construct intelligent beings out of water. Not in the monstrous way which you are probably first occurred to you. No. The thought of bodies soft and wet was foreign to him, and he aborted, as we all do. His intention was to construct beings from water that were truly beautiful and wise, therefore crystalline. He selected a planet far removed from any sun, cut mountains of ice with frozen oceans, and out of those carved the cryonids. They bore his name, this name, for only in the intense cold could they exist, and in the sunless void. Before long, they had built themselves cities and palaces of ice, and if any heat, whatever, threatened them with extinction, they trapped solar light in large transparent vessels, and with these illuminated their dwellings. He among them was more important the more polar lights he had, lemon, yellow, and silver. And they all lived happily, and loving not only light, but precious stones that grew famous for their gems. The gems, cut and ground from frozen gases, added color to this eternal light, which burned like imprisoned spirits, the thin polar lights resembling enchanted nebula in blocks of crystal. More than one cosmic conqueror wished to possess these riches, for all of Cryonia was visible at a great distance. Its facets, twinkling like jewels, rotated slowly on black velvet. And so adventurers came to Cryonia to try their hand in battle. The first to arrive was the Electro Knight Brass, whose step was as big as a bell tolling. But no sooner did he set foot on the sheets of ice that they melted from the heat. And down he plunged into the icy deep. The water closed over him. Like an insect in amber, he remains, to this very day, encased in a mountain of ice at the bottom of the Cryonian Sea. The fate of Brass did not deter other daredevils. After him came the Electro Knight Iron, who had drunk liquid helium until his teal innards gurgled, and the frost that formed upon his armor gave him the appearance of a snow giant. But in swooping to the surface of the planet, he heated up from the atmospheric friction. The liquid helium evaporated out of him with a whistle, and he himself, glowing red, landed on some crags of ice, which opened instantly. He pulled himself out, belching steam, similar to a boiling geyser. But everything he touched became a white cloud from which snow fell. So he sat and waited for himself to cool. And when the little stars of snow no longer melted on his shoulder plates, he sought to rise to go into battle. But the oil had congealed in his joints, and he could not even straighten his back. There he sits still, and the falling snow has made of him a white mountain, from which only the tip of his helmet protrudes. They call it Iron Mountain, and in its eye sockets gleam a frozen stare. News of the fate of his predecessors reached the third Electro Knight, Quartz, who in the day appeared as a polished lens and at night as a mirror filled with stars. He did not fear the oil in his limbs would congeal, for he hadn't any, nor that the ice floes would crack beneath his feet, for he could become as cold as he liked. There's only one thing he had to avoid, and this was prolonged thought. For it made his quartz brain grow warm, and that could destroy him. But he resolved to protect himself and gain victory over the Cryonids by the simple expedient of not thinking. He flew to the planet and was so chilled by his long voyage through the eternal galactic night that the iron meteors that grazed his breast in flight shattered into shivers with a twinkling sound. He sat down on the white snows of Cryonia, beneath its black sky like a jug of stars, and, resembling a transparent lens, began to ponder his next move. But the snow around him was already darkening and starting to steam. Uh-oh, Quartz said to himself. Not good. That's all right, just don't think and it's in the bag. He resolved to repeat this single phrase no matter what happened, for required no mental effort and therefore would not heat him up at all. So Quartz proceeded through the snowy wild, thoughtlessly and at random, in order to preserve his coolness. He walked thus till finally he came to the ice walls of the capital of the Cryonids, Frigida. He charged and struck the battlement with his head until the sparks flew, but that accomplished nothing. Let's try it differently, he said to himself, and considered how much 2 times 2 would be. Reflecting on this, his head became a trifle warmer. So he ran the glittering walls a second time, but made only a small dent. Not enough, he said to himself. Let's try something harder. How much is 3 times 5? His head was now surrounded by a sizzling cloud. For contact with such intense mentation, the snow instantly boiled. So Quartz stepped back, gathered up his speed, struck and went straight through the wall. And through 2 places behind it, plus 3 houses of the lesser counts of horror fell upon a great staircase and clunked the stalactite banister, but the steps were like skating, or like a skating rink. He jumped up quickly, for now everything about him was melting, and in this way he could go tumbling down through the entire city, down into the ice abyss, where he would be frozen forever. "That's all right, just don't think, it's in the bag," he told himself, and sure enough, he cooled off at once. So he went out into a tunnel of ice, which he had melted. He found himself in a great square lit on every side by polar lights that winked in emerald and silver in their crystal pillars. Then towards him issued forth, sparkling and starry, an enormous knight, the commander of the Cryonids, Boreal. Quartz pulled himself together and leaped to the attack, but the others closed about him, and there was a crash, when two icebergs in the middle of the North Sea collide. The gleaming right arm of Boreal fell away, sheared off at the socket, but nothing daunted, he turned, so that his chest, broad as a glacier, which in point of fact it was, faced the enemy. The enemy, meanwhile, gathered up momentum and once more rammed him savagely. And since quartz is harder and more dense than ice, Boreal split with a roar like an avalanche, moving down a rocky slope, and he lay all shattered in the glow of the polar lights that witnessed his defeat. "In the bag, just keep it up," said quartz, and tore from the fallen warrior jewels of wondrous beauty, rings set with hydrogen, clasps and medallions that shone like diamonds, though cut from the trio of noble glasses, argon, krypton, and xenon. When, however, he admired them, the warmth of that emotion warmed him. Consequently, the diamonds and sapphires evaporated with a hiss beneath his touch, so that he held nothing, save for a few droplets of dew, which also quickly vanished. "Uh-oh, can't admire either. No matter, just don't think," he said to himself, and forged on into the heart of the conquered city. In the distance, he saw a mighty figure approaching. It was Albucid the White, General Mineral, whose massive breast was crisscrossed with rows of icicle metals and the great star of Rim upon a glacial ribbon. That keeper of the royal treasure barred the way to quartz, who bore down upon him like a storm and smote him in a thunderclap of ice. Then Prince Astrobert, Lord of the Black Hail, came to the aid of Albusin. This knight, the Electro Knight, has met his match. The prince had on his costly nitrogen armor, tempered in helium. So fierce was the cold he gave off, it robbed quartz of his impetus, weakened his movements, and even the polar lights grew dim and pale. Such was the breath of absolute zero that spread about. Quartz pulled up and thought, "Yipes, what's going on?" And from the great astonishment, his brain heated. The absolute zero grew summery, and before his eyes, Astrobert himself began to break into chunks, with thunder accompanying the death throes, until only a heap of black ice dripping like tears remained in a puddle on the battlefield. "In the bag," said Quartz to himself, "just don't think. But if you have to think, then think. Either way, you win." And he pressed on, and his steps rang as though someone were hammering at crystals. And as he pounded through the streets of Frigida, its inhabitants peered out at him from under the white eaves, despair in their hearts. He was hurtling along like a mad meteor across the Milky Way, when in the distance he noticed a small and solitary figure. This was none other than Bargain, known as the Burr, the greatest sage among the Cryonids. Quartz built up speed, intending to crush him at a single blow, but the other stepped out of the way and raised two fingers. Quartz had no idea what this might mean, but he turned and went full tilt at his opponent. Yet once again, at the last moment, Barian stepped aside and quickly raised one finger. Quartz was somewhat surprised at this and slowed his pace. Though he had already turned around and was about to charge, he wondered, and the water began to pour from the neighboring homes. But he did not see this. For now, Barian was showing him a circle with his fingers and swiftly moving his thumb of the other hand back and forth through it. Quartz thought and thought of what those silent gestures were supposed to represent. While a chasm opened up beneath his feet, black water gushed forth, and he sank like a stone. And before he had time to say, "It's all right, just don't think," he was no more among the living. Later, the Cryonids, grateful to Barian for their deliverance, asked him what it was he had said he had intended to convey through the science he had made to the terrible rogue Electronite. "It's very simple, really," replied the sage. "Two fingers meant that there were two of us, he and I together. One finger that soon only I would be left. Then I showed him the circle, indicating that the ice was opening around him, and the ocean's black abyss would swallow him forever. He failed to understand the first, and likewise the second and third." "Oh, great wise one," exclaimed the astonished Cryonids. "How could you ever have given such signs to the dread invader? Think what would have happened if he had comprehended and disdained surprise. Surely then his mind would not have heeded, nor would he have plunged into the bottomless abyss." "Pooh, I had no fear of that," said Byron the Burr with an icy smile. "I knew all along he would not understand. If he'd had a greater sense to begin with, he never would have come here. For what use to a being that lives beneath the sun are jewels of gas and silver stars of ice?" They in turn marvel at the wisdom of the sage and so departed, satisfied each to the comforting chill of his own hearth. After this, no one ever again attempted to invade Cryonia, the entire universe not having any more such fools. Though some say there's plenty still, they merely do not know the way. And so you have the tale of the three Electronites.
My favorite part was the end, and I don't mean that in an insulting way, huh? What I mean is I love how it ends with what is sometimes considered almost, I guess, the pinnacle of contribution of pagan wisdom, which is symbolic and archetypal language and what can be learned from it. So it ends almost with, you know, sounding like a reading or something or a consulting, but not the... But he was volunteering it, the sage was. You know, he was saying, "Here, I've given you these symbols. I've given you the answer. If you're smart enough to read symbols, you could have figured this out." You know what I mean? And I kind of like that as the ending. That the mysteries of the universe were sort of, if you will, given to the invader, and they just simply weren't wise enough to see them. Yeah, I kind of like that.
Yeah, I love it, too. And it's a really classic theme. I've read several stories from Indian folklore, and I'm sure they, you know, are in many other folklores as well from around the world. But the classic story of, you know, the sage holds up one finger, or two fingers and one finger.
Yeah, we'll start.
And then, yeah, and the other person trying to figure out, what does it mean? What does it mean? They can't figure it out in the end. It's like, oh, it's so simple, you know.
And this takes me back to what you were saying to one of the callers about how you view tarot and readings and all of these things, and maybe symbolic language in general. They're consultants. Yes, I do think they come from a divine source, just like I think we come from a divine source, but the knowledge is inside of you, and you're using these archetypes through what some people might call your higher self. Not trying to go too far out into the cosmos. I'm just trying to get back to the point of these. The knowledge is there, and these things, like whether it's someone's using symbols, runes, in our case earlier, tarot, these symbols provide us with keys and clues, just as the wise sage was providing his enemy, in this case, in this story, with clues. and it helps us to unlock. That's why I have such a fascination with symbolic language, is it helps you to unlock things. And you start taking a different journey that isn't so absolute, because you start seeing the similarities in things, and which is what I think is one of the other valuable things, talking about tarot again, about tarot, is one of its fascinating things is when you first start learning it, it teaches you how similar everybody is, and that everybody kind of does the same dumb stuff. Oh, here's the fool, or here's the fool reversed. Oh, you're being scared. You're not taking a chance. Everybody has the fool. Yeah, everyone's either the fool or they're afraid to be the fool, right, at some point in their lives. So, like, for me, for instance, I can't imagine that someone would – this is going to sound like a funny example – but someone would learn tarot and say still be racist, for instance. Because when you learn archetypal language like that, it makes you see how similar everybody is, in my opinion. You know, it's like you see the similarity that we're all doing the same stupid stuff, and occasionally we get lucky and learn a lesson from it. And that's kind of how I view it, you know.
You know, and you shouldn't need a tarot to see these things.
Well, of course.
It takes something like that.
Of course. And
obvious as it is.
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, I never had that sort of, you know, I think it's ridiculous that people have that sort of, you know, negativity in them. To me, it seems like a lot of stress to walk around with, to walk around, you know, hating a group of people. Almost seems like it would age you, doesn't it? But people have their reasons, some more legit than others, but some people have been dramatically wronged by one group, you know, in their lifetime and developed these belief systems. Some are just raised that way. But to me, I see the commonality in humanity in everything. It's just my nature, probably. But back to the point.
Well, in astrology, tarot, you know, what we see, everyone has these qualities. Everyone has all 22 trumps of the major arcana within them. Everyone has all 12 signs, all 7, 9, or 11 planets, however many. All the forces are at work within us, within every human being. So, you know, with that in mind, as Dan was saying, show compassion, understanding, all in this together, strange creatures that we are.